Did you know that over 60,000 new tracks are uploaded to Spotify every single day? That's a new track every 1.4 seconds, and that's just on one platform. With so much music now available, it's more important than ever to stand out from the crowd. So it's not surprising that more artists are starting to use less conventional sonic textures in their music, like field recordings. Perhaps you've always wanted to infuse the sounds of nature or your favourite city into your own tracks, but not having the right gear or knowledge might have held you back. Well, if that's the case, you're going to love the brand new guide I just created teaching you how to start field recording with just a smartphone, and it's all yours for free at femalediymusician.com/learnwithisabel. Yep, you really do just need a humble smartphone and some minimal extra gear that doesn't have to break the bank to get started with field recording. And I've laid it all out in this handy 5-point checklist. So download it for free at femalediymusician.com/learnwithisabel and elevate your music to the next level.
I don't know. It makes me feel physically ill that we're letting colleagues within the industry face this and experience this treatment, and nothing has been done to address it. Like, you should never be made to feel that you have to bring a white male or a white colleague in general, no matter what their gender is, into a meeting to make someone else feel at ease. Like, that was horrifying.
Hello and welcome to Girls Twiddling Knobs. My name's Isabel, and over the last decade, my self-produced and self-released music has amassed over 25 million Spotify streams. I also have a PhD in sonic arts, but I wasn't always this confident with music tech. In fact, I still hear those self-doubt gremlins in my head from time to time. I started this podcast to help more female-identifying musicians start recording and producing their music and learn from other women making music with technology. If that's your cup of tea, then you're in the right place, my friend. Let's dive in. Can I just ask a cheeky question? How good is this podcast? On a scale of 1 to 5, seriously, it's a 5, right? I mean, we've had some fascinating guests. I always bring my A game, and we have a laugh here and there, don't we? Not to mention the hashtag tough love, hashtag knowledge bombs, and hashtag relatable conversation I'm dropping on the weekly. So I think we can all agree that it's high time you rated and reviewed the podcast. I mean, like, right now, just hit pause wherever you're listening from and spread the love, because it's not just for my ego, I promise. It genuinely helps more women and girls discover these wonderful episodes and start to build their confidence with music technology. Okay, I'm glad that we've covered that, but on with this week's episode. Today, I am delighted to welcome audio engineer Emma Butt to the podcast. Now, Emma has over 12 years' experience in post-production audio and has credits on shows such as Game of Thrones, EastEnders, and Doctor Who, to name a few. But recently, Emma also undertook a research project commissioned by the Sir Lenny Henry Centre for Media Diversity and published in the journal Representology into diversity in the UK TV industry, or lack thereof. Therefore, I really wanted to find out more and invited Emma onto the podcast. Now, we had a deep dive in conversation, and so I'll not waste any more of your time. Let's just dive right in. Welcome to Girls Twiddling Knobs, Emma. It's wonderful to have you here today on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I feckin' love the name as well. Good name.
It's such a silly, ridiculous name, but I'm really glad that you like it. I'm really, really glad that you're here. I think that it's going to be really nice to hear from someone who's, you know, definitely still, you know, in audio and sound clearly, but from more of a TV, documentary, film post-production background. Because obviously, we're looking at women not just in music, but using sound and audio in general.
So
that'd be really nice to kind of get your perspective and listen to your experiences. But also, you've just published some really fascinating research, which we will get into in a little bit, which I think people listening to the podcast are going to find really interesting and insightful, and probably in lots of ways not that surprising. But let's just start with you and your background. So maybe can you just tell us, Who are you, Emma? Where are you from? What are you doing?
Oh my gosh, what a big question. Who am I? we won't get into the worldly answer of that one. So I obviously the accent will hopefully give me away. I'm Irish. I'm not British, which actually surprised someone quite recently that only knew me from Twitter. I started out my career in Dublin. I actually didn't want to do post-production at all. I wanted to do music. I kind of wanted to go to university to study sound engineering for music and go into live sound. So I did work experience in a venue for a year while I was still in university. Absolutely hated it. It was the most sexist experience I have ever gone through.
Okay, well, look, I mean, maybe we could talk about that for a little bit then, just because that's probably going to be very interesting for people listening to this. What was it about it that felt like that, Emma?
Well, it was a really, really odd situation in that the engineer of the venue had obviously given me an opportunity to come in and learn from him. But yet he was really... So there's me and a guy who were training at the same time, and he totally treated me differently to the guy. So I would try and learn from him. I'd try and... do the cable runs, set the monitors up, set all the equipment up. But because I was a girl, it was deemed that I wasn't strong enough to set the equipment up. So he would always go to James, who was the other assistant engineer, and ask him to do it. I wasn't allowed near the desk, even though James was allowed near it. If I asked a question, it was deemed a stupid question. Whereas if James asked the same question, or I asked James to ask a question for me, it was deemed a really interesting and, you know, good question to ask. And it wasn't just from him. It was all, actually, there was one thing he did, which was, I still can't believe that I kind of let this pass. He had a slut light. And what it was there's a light, obviously, on the desk, the mixing desk in the venue. And when gigs would start, he would turn said slut light into the crowd to pick out all of the women he deemed as, you guessed it.
Oh my God.
It was oh really, really horrific.
That's terrible.
Yeah.
That's really, like, it's actually quite scary, isn't it? You know, because you just feel like it's like a predator picking off prey or something.
Yeah. It was unbelievable. And he was also actually... I remember having a conversation with him one day, and he was like, you know, if you want to be successful in this industry, you're going to have to start dressing like a man, cut your hair and, you know, just not be any way like a woman. And if you don't do that, you're not going to succeed. And he started telling me this story about a stage manager who was also a woman who's really successful. And he was like, the only reason she's successful is because she doesn't dress like a woman. She dressed boyish, and I was just like, well, no, I'm not going to do that, so feck you. And I used to get it from the musicians as well. Like, obviously, I'd be on the stage trying to set up, and they'd either be hitting on me, or they just wouldn't look me in the eye. They wouldn't acknowledge me. They would want to ask questions, technical questions. And even though I was clearly on stage helping set up, they would completely ignore me and try and find James or try and find the house engineer to go and ask questions. And it was easy questions that I could have really answered for them. But the whole thing was just infuriating. So I stuck it out for a year, and I was just like, no, I do not want to do a career of this. This is horrific.
Yeah, it's really, there's so many things that, you know, come to my mind when we're talking about this, your experience here. And like, one of them is, I'm actually at the moment putting together a whole podcast episode on how these experiences of sexism shape our self-esteem with technology and our ability to just kind of sometimes almost galvanize us, though, to power forward nevertheless, yeah. like makes us even more, have even more conviction to, you know, express ourselves and excel with technology or, you know, other means as well. What do you think it made you feel, Emma? Did it dent your self-esteem, or did it just make you feel even more, you know, certain that you were not going to take that shit and you were going to plow forward anyway?
I think I definitely went the side of it dented my confidence, and it took a very, very long time for me to get my confidence back. Well, not even back, but this was at the very, very start of my career. Like, I wasn't even fully working at that stage. I was still in university learning, and this was my first introduction to the industry. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't even getting off on, you know, having confidence going out into the working world. I was starting out the working world being like, fuck, this is how I'm going to be treated. Also, sorry for cursing, I curse a lot.
That's fine.
it really did affect me. And that I also suffered with a lack of confidence when I went into my first job in post-production, because I will always say the first company that I worked for, which I worked for 9 years and I absolutely loved, looking back on it now, it's definitely been the company that I've been treated the best, and I mm-hmm. experienced very little sexism. Mm-hmm. But looking back now, I can see instances where I did face sexism and I didn't realize it at the time. And that also dented my confidence. There used to be myself and one other woman in the sound department as staff. And then there was freelancers who were women who used to come into the company too. But myself and the other woman, we used to have conversations about how one of the mixers who had been there a very, very long time treated us totally different and was really disrespectful and spoke down to us more so than he would to our male counterparts in the same department. And I mean, myself and the other woman that I worked with, we were both getting nominated for awards. We were both quite successful in what we were doing, and we were producing good work, and we had clients who only wanted to work with us. Yet he still deemed us as, you know, not very good, and was constantly criticizing us and criticizing our work. And that definitely affected my confidence too. And it's like, my confidence is still not there. I still question my work constantly, but I also think that is hand in hand with being a good engineer. You always need to be self-critical and never arrogant and think that you know it all. But yeah, having confidence to walk into a room of men in a sound team on, you know, any film or TV job, it's taken quite a long time for me to be able to walk into that room, voice my opinion, and be confident that what I'm saying is correct and not back down if a male counterpart argues with me or disagrees with me.
Yeah. I think so many people listening to this will be able to relate to that. It's really hard, especially if it's just been reinforced time and time again, like you're describing. And I'm sure that even before you started your degree, you'd had that reinforced in other ways, maybe in other parts of your life, perhaps more because of being a woman as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm mixed race. I'm half Pakistani, half Irish. So my confidence was shot as a child, because growing up in Ireland in the early 90s, there are no other brown people around. There is one other, so besides myself and my dad, there was one other brown person on our street, and that was an elderly man. But in school, there was no other kids who were from different backgrounds. So I got racially bullied quite badly as a child. So obviously that affects your confidence too. So then going into the working world, I've already got this lack of confidence because I've been outcast by kids because I was deemed different. And then I decide to go into a career that is predominantly male dominated as a woman. And I'm outcast again because of my gender. So there's just no winning.
Yeah. And also, you know, from looking at the report that you put together, and also just my presumption is probably that environment was very white as well, as being very male too.
Yeah. The company that I was with in Dublin, it got bought out by an American company the year I decided to leave and move to the UK. And when it was bought out, one of the American like heads of the company decided to come over and tour the facility and meet everybody. But obviously, because we were such a big company, he only had time to meet certain people. And at the time, it was myself and we had a receptionist who was Mexican. So we were the only two people of color in the whole company. And we joked because we were chosen to meet this like head guy from the state. And we were like, oh yeah, we're the token diversity being touted out just for this visit. Yeah. And we'll be hidden back in our rooms away from everybody as soon as he's gone. And I do think that was the case. They had to show that I wasn't all white.
Yeah. Well, no, it's really interesting, and thank you for being so honest and vulnerable about, you know, how your self-esteem had been affected by those different experiences with people. But what I'm also hearing though, Emma, is that there is a kind of determination, there is also a conviction in you, because, you know, as you describe it to me right now, you're saying, well, I did a year of that, you know, working in that venue, in that environment during my degree. And I said, hell no, this is not going to be my career. And other people might have said, oh, well, I guess this is just what I'll have to do then. I guess I'll just have to dress like a boy, even though that doesn't feel like me. And I'll have to just become one of the boys, even though I don't really want to. And I don't feel like I should have to. And I'll just get on with it, because that is, you know, I've talked to other women who are in more kind of engineering, the sort of more behind the scenes aspects of music and sound. Mm. And there are women that resign themselves to that. And there are women that maybe feel that does actually, that is their identity and they're fine with that. But I can hear in you that you had at least the confidence to say, actually, no, that's not me. And I'm not going to do that.
I don't know if I'd say confidence and more stubbornness. I take after my mother, and I was just like, no. When I was told that I had to dress like a man, I don't wear trousers ever. It's kind of a known thing amongst my friends. The only time I wear trousers is gym sessions. So I don't own jeans, I don't own anything. I wear skirts and dresses all of the time, because
yes, that's great.
That's my style, and that's how I project my personality, is through my clothes, and I love my clothes.
I don't have the hair removal discipline for that, Emma.
Well, that's what tights were invented for.
I don't think they're enough.
I know the feeling right now, I'm not gonna lie. Do you know what? You can't see me right now because, as I said, my camera's buggered, but I'm wearing a bright yellow jumper. And yeah, I call it my happy jumper. So when it's like dull and miserable out, I wear my sunshine on me. Which is my yellow.
That's a great idea.
But that's my personality. And I think that's really important. So when someone says to me, you can't dress the way you want to, you can't dress the way that reflects your personality because you're not going to be successful, I take that as a challenge. And I'm like, well, fuck you. I'm going to do what I like, you sod. And it's definitely the stubbornness of my mother coming out in my personality.
Yeah. No, I think it's so interesting, isn't it, that sometimes that something overrides something like, well, as you call it, stubbornness. Yeah. But maybe it's just intuition and self-belief and knowing yourself that it overrides that pressure to conform in another way. It's one of those, it's that decision that a lot of us make continuously throughout our careers, I think, of, you know, whether to conform or whether to go to the beat of somebody else's drum, or whether to listen to what we really feel and know we need. And I think it's really hard if you're not part of that kind of mainstream demographic, because then you will inevitably be missing out on some opportunities. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, completely. And I mean, look, there's definitely been experiences in my career where I've been told I have to conform. So part of the reason why I'm freelance now is because of the way I got treated in facilities in the UK. And without a doubt, looking back now, they wanted me to conform to a certain image, a certain way that they worked. We weren't allowed. It sounds like a really stupid thing, but in nearly every facility that I've worked, you had to use the head of audio's mixing template. Now, their template could be laid out slightly different to how you're used to, or they could use different plugins that you're not used to, or they could just have a different signal flow that you're not used to. In my mind, as long as you produce something that the client is happy with and that is to a high standard, it doesn't matter how you get there once what you're delivering is correct. That's not the attitude of most post facilities. The attitude is you do it our way or you don't do it at all. And that's another way of conforming. And I totally disagreed with that methodology when I worked in post facilities. I was like, well, if I'm making the clients happy, which is making them return to your facility, which is in return, you know, earning you money and, you know, putting income into the facility, then what does it matter what way I get to that end result? As long as it's a way that I'm comfortable of working, it's a way I'm used to working, and everyone is happy at the end. And I was always met with, no, that's not the way we do it. We don't do that like here. And it really, really frustrated me. And that was another thing that ended up knocking my confidence, because I was told, no, you're doing it wrong. And actually, it wasn't that I was doing it wrong. It was I was doing it in a different way that they weren't used to.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that is a big one when you have low confidence, and that may or may not be because of experiences, because of your demographic, you know, that whether you're a woman or you're not white or you're disabled, that you can get second guess yourself rather than just immediately going to, well, maybe I just do something differently.
Yeah.
Or maybe they're wrong. Or maybe there's no wrong or right about this. You know, you'll automatically go to, oh, crap, I did it wrong again.
Exactly. And you shouldn't be made to feel like that, especially in an industry where, I hate this phrase, but there's so many ways to skin a cat. I definitely need to find a different way of saying that, because that is a horrible, horrible image. But there's so many different ways to achieve an end result. And there is no right or wrong way, as you've said. It is a creative industry. There should be creative ways in achieving what we need to get to. And I just hate when the "you're doing it the wrong way" phrase comes out of people's mouth, because it's not right. And it's actually one thing that I say when I go into universities and I give talks. I always say, this is the way I approach my work, but this is not the only way. If you find a way that works better for you, then totally do it. As long as you're achieving what the client wants, then you're doing it correctly.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really great thing for people to hear, because it's useful to hear someone like yourself and other people who are professionals in the music and sound and audio industries saying, actually, there's not one way to do something. There's not one way to produce a piece of audio, to, you know, mix something, to record something. There's many different ways. And it's about getting to that end point, and how you get there can take many different paths.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to skip over your background, Emma. So remind me, you're doing your degree, and remind me of the name of your degree again.
So I went to a college called Pulse Recording Studios, which was actually a proper, fully fledged recording studio that offered courses in sound engineering. So it was a university, I use air quotes there. But it was also a fully functioning studio. So we got the best of both worlds. So if you were, you know, showing really good skill as an engineer, they would try and get you in on proper working sessions. So you could get a bit of hands-on experience. We also had like the full mixing studio to actually learn in, which was incredible. And all of the lecturers were also working full time in the industry. We had an incredible, the owner was a guy called Tony Perry, who I don't actually know if he's still working or if he's retired now. But he was amazing, and his sessions used to be incredible. And he'd been in the industry for, I don't know, donkey's years. But he was just so warm and so friendly and freely giving of his knowledge. And it was just the most incredible environment to be in. And the co-owner of the studio was also a woman. So she was a great like role model to look up to. And she was always actively trying to get more women onto the course. So it was, I think there was four different groups within our year. And of those four different groups, there was about five women. So it wasn't great, but she was actively trying to get more women into it. So I did my course there. It was coming up to 3 months until I was going to finish. It was a 2-year course. And I started getting a panic, being like, oh, feck, need to get a job. I'm about to finish college and I have to go out into the working world and bugger.
So I've been there.
So I just started researching all of the studios in Dublin, both music and post-production, and start applying for runner positions. And it just so happened, the company that I work for, Screen Scene, were looking for runners at the time. So I went in for an interview. They told me they would get back to me by the Friday to let me know if I got the job. And Friday came, hadn't heard anything. So I kind of followed it up and I sent an email. I was just like, you know, just wanted to check in, see if any decision had been made about the position. And I got a phone call within an hour of sending that email. And basically what had happened was they had met me, thought I was going to be too timid to do the job, so had offered the position to another girl. She had started on that particular Friday and went on her lunch break and never came back.
Oh, dear.
she absolutely hated it.
Oh, no.
It was kind of, it worked out so well for me. Because as I emailed, they had realized she wasn't coming back. I think she just literally disappeared. Like, they never heard another word from her, which I kind of admire her for doing.
Yeah. There's certainly been jobs I've wanted to do that in.
Yeah, exactly. So you've got to, you know, respect to her. She was just like, screw this, and walked out. But it was really bad because I had pulled a sickie from college that day. And obviously I needed to, so they called me up and they offered me this job and they wanted me to start on the Monday. But obviously I was still in college. Mm. So I needed to finish my course part-time. So annoyingly, I had pulled the sickie and then I had to run into college and speak to my lecturers and be like, look, I've been offered this job. It's in a post-production facility, but they want me to start immediately. Can I finish my course part-time and work there full-time? And they were actually great about it. They were really delighted I had gotten a job. So they were like, absolutely, that's fine. You can do both. So I started there. Failed my exams in university.
Oh no.
Yeah. It was really bad. God. But I was taking on a lot. Like, I was trying to work full time, do my coursework. But also what I was trying to do when I started was sit in with the engineers before and after my shifts and get them to give me projects that I could work on in my spare time so I could develop my skills. So I wasn't surprised really when I failed my exams, but I retook them and it was all fine. And I passed and, you know.
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah. I think that's a really good lesson for people listening, that sometimes you just have to run with something that comes, an opportunity that comes on your lap, and then you can pick up, you know, not everything in your life, but you can pick up most things in your life later on down the line.
Yeah.
And you just have to kind of follow that and be a bit impulsive sometimes.
Yeah, I definitely say sometimes, but
sometimes.
I mean, I think when it comes to your career, if you think that there is a good opportunity there and it's something that you've always wanted, I'm always of the belief that you should take it and run with it. And that's kind of what I did with the job, and it worked out really well. I mean, I had 9 years in that company that were amazing.
Wow. Yeah. And I'm just wondering, you know, when you're talking there, had you decided before you applied for that job that you wanted to go more into film, TV, post-production rather than music by that point?
I definitely decided that I didn't want to work in a recording studio.
Because why was that?
Well, we had done some recording studio sessions as part of our course, one of them being an overnight session. And it was literal hell.
Oh God!
All of the musicians decided to bring beer with them for the session and got pissed as farts while we were trying to work, and it was just horrendous. So yeah. I was like, okay, I don't want to do this. So I was still in two minds about what I wanted to do, and I had an interest in post production. I thought it was a fascinating subject. We had done a kids animation as part of our course where it was Tom and Jerry, and we just had the picture and we had to recreate all the sound for it. And when we started to do that, I was like, this is really fun. Like recreating all the concepts, the sound effects, the atmospheres. And I was like, oh, I actually kind of enjoy this. So when I was starting to look into different studios to apply for, that's kind of why I started looking at post houses, because I was like, actually, I might enjoy this if I try it.
Yeah.
And I was right. I did. I absolutely loved it. I just fell in love with the post-production process and how, especially with something like kids animation, where you were literally taking words on a script and creating a world from nothing.
It's so creative, that, isn't it? It's basically composition.
Yeah. And it's something that totally gets overlooked. I always get really frustrated by when you have like the Oscars or the BAFTAs and you'll have an animation film up against, you know, like a drama or, you know, something that's been shot in the real world. And the animation never gets the recognition it deserves, because everybody who is involved in that process has literally created something from nothing. They haven't had, you know, the world outside to shoot on their cameras. They've had to, you know, in some cases, hand draw it. None of the sound is sync sound from the world outside. It is all sound that has been recreated by a sound editor or sound designer. Every single footstep that wasn't picked up on set either, that has been placed in by a sound editor. The work that goes into it is unbelievable. And yeah, it's never given enough recognition.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really interesting one, isn't it? Anything, a lot of stuff that's for children, I think, gets overlooked in general, as opposed to stuff that's for adults.
Yeah, it's one of the things, actually, when it came to me doing the report, there's certain sections of the industry that if you have come from those areas, you're not deemed to be skilled enough to go into high-end drama. And kids is one of them. So it's hard to prove it in sound, but definitely I know that directors have faced this in their careers, where if they've started off by directing kids TV, they find it very, very difficult to go into high-end drama. They can usually have to do the career path of going into kids animation or kids TV, then going into entertainment shows, and then from there, trying to find a way into high-end drama. But it's very, very difficult to do that. Trying to get out of kids' TV in general is really, it's a really difficult career progression. When in fact, like, kids' TV is really difficult to do because you've got kids involved. And, like, you know, they're awkward little feckers, but also you've got filming restrictions. You can only, like, and especially with the voice recording for kids for animation, you can only record, I don't know if it's different in the UK, but in Ireland, you can only record kids for 2 hours at a time. And I think it's a total of like 4 or 6 hours a week, and that's it. So it's really, really restrictive. So you have to be really good at your schedule and your planning and making sure that you've decided in advance what you're going to use, what you need. You know, it's full respect to anybody who works in kids TV. It's not easy. And yeah, it's never easy to then progress from there, which is bizarre.
No, I mean, I can imagine that that makes sense to me. But for you, what have you kind of specialized in then, Emma? What kind of type of audiovisual media have you gone into?
So I'm a bit of an odd one in that I do everything. I think over here in the UK, you kind of decide on if you want to be a dialogue editor, sound effects editor, or a re-recording mixer, or an ADR recordist, and you decide what genre you're going to stick with. So whether it's entertainment and factual, whether it's animation, or whether it's film. And I've not done that because that's not how we work in Ireland. Because the industry is so small in Ireland, you do anything and everything. You have to do that basically to have a career and to earn. So I go across all genres and across all job titles. And I've started branching more into recording voices for video games. I do voice records for audiobooks as well, which is absolutely lovely. It's one of my favorite things to do. And then I also do, obviously, my TV stuff. So I do dialogue editing and sound editing and mixing on TV shows and documentaries, films, trying to get more and more into drama, which is for sound, very, very difficult to do if you've come from the entertainment and factual side of the industry. So yeah, kind of Jill of all trades, as I say.
Mm. And you've got credits on Doctor Who, Game of Thrones, and now you're currently working on EastEnders, right?
I am indeed, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And you know that I am a big EastEnders fan.
You have, Fred. Did you watch it at Christmas? Did you watch like
this? I didn't. Look, I'm going to confess here, Emma, right? With EastEnders, I stopped watching it during lockdown when it wasn't on, the first lockdown.
Yeah.
And then I never got back into it because I think when I had the time away from it, I think I just realised how how bad it can be. I also love it, but there's just some of my favourite characters are now not there, like Pat and Peggy.
Yeah. Barbara Windsor.
Oh, yeah, and little Mo. Mo was a great character, and they've gone. Mm-hmm. And so I haven't actually been following it ever since it came back on. But prior to that, I watched EastEnders religiously every week for literally about 8 years.
Oh my God.
So yeah, I have been a very, very big EastEnders fan. But yeah, you're now working in that kind of real forefront of British drama there.
I don't know if I go quite that far, but yeah. you know what? I love the EastEnders team, and it's one of those ones that no matter who you speak to in the UK, they know what the show is. Mm. It's one of those great jobs that everybody knows EastEnders. Everybody at some point has seen an episode, whether they loved it or hated it, they have watched it at some stage. So it's a cool one to be involved in. But yeah, I've been lucky. I've done a lot of different shows. I got to do Alan Bennett's Talking Heads during, which was incredible because it was shot on the EastEnders sets. And I had just finished off the last couple of episodes before EastEnders took the hiatus. They asked me if I wanted to do that show as well. So I got to do 4 episodes of that. And that was just amazing. Like Alan Bennett's monologues are just beautiful. And one of my favorite ones, oh my God, The Shrine. If anybody is going to watch the remakes of his Talking Head series, I would highly recommend The Shrine. It made me cry, and I don't cry at all. But it was just
wonderful.
Yeah, it was beautiful performance, and it's one of those jobs that I just am so grateful that I got to be a part of. I loved it.
Yeah. No, that's fantastic. I mean, would you say that kind of, it sounds like you like those intimate monologue-y type productions, like the audiobook. Do you think that's your favourite, or is there something else I've missed that you enjoy even more?
I like working on shows and documentaries that are, as I describe it, soft and gentle. I'm not a person who wants to go and work on the next Transformers or, you know, Mission Impossible. They're not my style. I think every engineer has a particular style, and mine is anything that's soft and gentle, has a really good story to it, is always going to be more realistic with their sound and less out there sound designy. That's not my forte. That's not what I enjoy doing. I like doing real stories. And I think that's why I enjoy documentaries as well, because it's real stories about real people and it's real emotion. It's not, you know, made up. It's not artificial. Yeah. And that's what I enjoy. And it's the same with audiobooks. A lot of the time, audiobooks, you're getting real emotion. I don't think that comes across in like Mission Impossible. As much as I love Tom Cruise, no.
Okay, well, maybe we'll move on now. I mean, there's so much that we could talk about, but let's talk about the research that you published in the journal Representology. So if I'm right, this was research that was funded by the Lenny Henry Centre of Media Diversity.
Yep, that's correct.
Yes, and it says it's supported by Dr. Ellie Tomsett of Birmingham City University School of Media. Did she help with sourcing some of the research that you did, or did she kind of mentor you with it?
She mentored me and made me sound intelligent because otherwise it would have been full of Irishisms if I had been left to my own devices. So Ellie is a fucking legend and made me sound like I could string a sentence together. It was part of the process. So they obviously gave me a grant to do this research. And as part of that, as part of the grant, they also paired me with a mentor. So it was someone who had done academic research before, because obviously I had never done it. And it was someone who could guide me and give me advice and be a sounding board and, you know, check over my work. And like, there's things that I didn't even think I would need to know about, like ethics and making sure that everybody signed an ethics form, that I was aware of, like the ethics of my paper and, you know, the do's and don'ts. And yeah, so she was just a godsend helping me. So yeah, when it says Ellie Thompson on there, she was a big part of that research.
Great. I mean, it sounds like a really good scheme because, you know, in case anyone's listening actually that thinks they might be a good fit for this, they do have grants that you can apply for. Maybe you could tell us why did you decide to do this research? That I'll just so any in case anyone's wondering, the article's called Diversity in Post-Production Sound Roles in UK Television Production. So why did you feel the need to go and research diversity in post-production?
So I've been working in the industry about 12, 13 years now, and I was very conscious of the fact that I am usually one of the only or very few women in the room on post-production sound teams. And that was really starting to bother me. And I have to always try and be diplomatic about when I tell why I did this. So I remember being at a BAFTA crew talk, and it was with someone very, very well known within the sound world. And I brought up diversity. I brought up, you know, gender diversity within sound. And I remember this person, a white man, saying to me, "Oh, there's no problem with gender diversity in post-production sound anymore. We sorted that out years ago." And this,
oh my God.
Yeah. And this is about 3 years ago. And for a white man to say this to a woman of mixed race, I was just like, you're incorrect on that.
Yeah.
So I started to get involved with different organizations within the UK. And my whole purpose of doing that was to try and help find ways to address diversity within post-production sound, because that's the industry I know. And I was tired of being the only woman in the room or one of very few women in the room. And I was tired of not seeing anybody mixed race like myself or of any different ethnic minority background. So what I was finding, though, with these organizations was that I was getting aggression and fight back when I tried to bring up diversity. And it was microaggression. I don't think they even realized what they were doing. It just got to a point where I was like, I cannot do this with these organizations anymore. There's too much politics, there's too much red tape, and there's too much of people believing that they're not in the wrong or that there's not an issue here. Mm-hmm. So I stepped away from them and I was like, okay, if I want to prove my point, and show that there is an issue within post-production sound that we need to start addressing, I need facts and figures. I need to show it in black and white that here are the numbers, here's the problem. So I decided to look at the highest rated TV shows over a 3-month period over the terrestrial television stations in the UK, because obviously Netflix and Amazon, it's hard to get the figures for their streaming. They don't release that data. So I decided I was going to do that independently. And in the meantime, I had been following this incredible guy called Marcus Ryder, who is now an MBE, on Twitter. And he had been following me, and he contacted me out of the blue. And he was heading up the Lenny Henry Center at the time and kind of said to me, look, you know, the Lenny Henry Center is trying to address these issues. And I was thinking maybe we could try and find a way of working with you. And he said, you know, have you got anything, or is there anything you're planning, or is there anything you're thinking about doing? And I said, well, I'm thinking about doing this research. And he said, well, what about doing that research through the Lenny Henry Center? Because the thing is, if you do that through us, having the center behind you gives you more weight when you go into meetings with mm-hmm. broadcasters, which is what I intend to do. And it's not just Emma Butt is going in and saying, here's the facts and figures, there is an issue. It's Emma Butt, supported by the Lenny Henry Centre, is coming in and saying, we have researched these facts and figures. We have addressed that there is, we're showing you in black and white that there is a problem and that we need to resolve this and we need to find a way to address it. And yeah, that's kind of all how it came about. So I was like, oh, yeah, definitely, I'm totally up for this. And yeah, now we've got the paper to show it.
It's so encouraging and inspiring to hear you talk about, you know, that you knew that you had to go about things a certain way, and then you did, and now you will have something you can use to hopefully make more of an impact in those boardrooms and those meetings. And, you know, I just want to commend you for doing that work, Emma, because it's exhausting and it's tiring. And already by the time you've even started doing the research, you've already experienced all this, you know, all these knockbacks and, like you're saying, these microaggressions. That in itself is so draining. So, you know, thank you for continuing and persevering.
Thank you.
But so maybe you can tell us a little bit about what did the research entail then? I mean, I've looked through the article and I can see you obviously interviewed people. So how did you go about gathering this research, and what were your biggest findings as well?
So the first thing I did was obviously try and find the highest rated TV shows. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, the first thing I did was just decide what time of the year and when I was going to pick the 3 months to research. And the advice that the centre gave me was, do not go for summer and do not go for the Christmas period, because summer is usually live events and Christmas period is usually repeats and films. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, so they're out. So I decided to go for the autumn of 2019 because it was, you know, recent enough that I could still find a lot of the shows online on iPlayers. So I could make sure that, obviously, I needed to check all of the credits to make sure that my data was correct. So I could still find them online easily enough. It was also recent enough, you know, it wasn't 5-6 years ago. So the data was going to be relevant. And Broadcast Magazine do this great thing where they publish the breakdown of each quarter of the year and the highest rated TV shows in that quarter on all of the terrestrial TV shows. So I started with that. Found out all of the teams using IMDb, the credits on the end of the show, and contacting people directly, like the post-production supervisors of some shows, where I couldn't find all the data that I needed. And then I had to contact every single person directly and ask them specific questions like their age, their gender, if they had a disability. There was a questionnaire that I had to send out to everybody. Now, some people didn't reply, and that was fine. They have their reasons. Nearly everybody did, which I'm very, very thankful for. You know, they did get back to me. So after that was collected, Ellie suggested interviewing people to get a firsthand experience of what people were going through, because the facts and figures are great, but we also need to have personal stories. So that's when I started interviewing people, and I needed to make sure that I had a diverse range of voices. So I had someone who was still at quite an assistant level in their career, a woman who had been in the industry quite a long time. I had a man who was from an ethnic minority background who was also had changed, done a mid-career change, and was trying to break into post-production sound. And I had two men who had been in the industry quite a long time, who were from ethnic minority backgrounds and had started their own companies as a result of not being able to get enough work.
And I think this is a really interesting, relevant one for a lot of women in music too, because a lot of the time women in music will, well, not a lot of the time, but you see every now and then women starting up female identifying only record labels or female only bands. And I thought there was a real correlation there with what you're saying in the article, where this, on the one hand, is great because it gives you more autonomy and you're able to work with, you know, hopefully a bit more kind of respect and representation in your immediate work environment. However, does this then cut you out of some of the bigger opportunities?
I think from what I gathered from the people that I spoke to, I don't think the two men felt that they had been, their career had suffered by deciding to start up their own companies. Mm-hmm. I think they felt that they had definitely prospered more than if they hadn't.
That's great.
But that is me speaking for them. They may have a different answer, you know, if you ask them directly, which obviously you can't because you don't know who they are. But I think that was the impression that I got from them, was that, you know, they were happy that they had made that decision, and it resulted in them, both of them have had, you know, good careers now as a result of that. But I think had they stayed in companies, it would have been, yeah, it wouldn't have been a happier story.
Well, that's really good to hear. So what do you think were the biggest findings from this research that you did, Emma?
I mean, the most upsetting one was one of the men saying that basically he felt on certain occasions that he had to bring a white male colleague with him to meetings with potential new clients, because he felt if he didn't, it was going into the lion's den and the clients might not feel as ease in a meeting with just a black man.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was horrific. And I remember having, you know, having this conversation with him, and he was telling me this, and I was like, oh, I literally said, oh my God, that's horrific. And he said, why are you saying, oh my God, for? And I was like, well, that shouldn't be happening. And he was like, well, it does. That's just the way it is. And he had just become so resigned to the fact that that's how the industry works. And I was actually I was recording an audiobook recently and speaking to the actress who was recording it, and she was black as well. And I told her this, and she said, there was no surprise on her face whatsoever. And she was just like, yeah, that's what we all go through.
Mm-hmm.
And to hear that is just, I don't know, it makes me feel physically ill that we are letting colleagues within the industry face this and experience this treatment, and nothing has been done to address it. Like, you should never be made to feel that you have to bring a white male or a white colleague in general, no matter what their gender is, into a meeting to make someone else feel at ease. Like,
yeah,
that was horrifying. The other thing that really got to me was one of the women, when she had left a company and gone freelance, she went to have a meeting with a sound supervisor about joining his team. And he was reluctant to hire her in case she got into a relationship with one of the other men on his team and the relationship went sour and they broke up and it would lead to tension on the team. Now, firstly, she was not heterosexual. She was gay. So totally made an assumption about her sexuality. Mm-hmm. But also, what the hell? Like,
yeah,
what, you can't hire a woman just in case she decides she falls in love with a man and it all goes to shit? No, she's a professional. She's very fucking good at her job. And that's the only thing that should matter, not anything else.
Yeah. But I think that, again, I mean, when you're telling me this, I feel a bit like the people that you mentioned before in terms of race and bringing a white colleague in. It doesn't shock me that someone might think that, and that as women, you know, a lot of the time just our presence means that people are worried that the vibe will turn sexual, you know, and the vibe will turn unprofessional, because in that situation, really, he's saying, I'm worried that my male colleagues will lose their focus because I'm putting a woman into the scenario. You could see it like that.
Yeah. And I can totally get what you're saying, but my brain works in the way I'm like, well, tell them to put it in their pants and cop.
Oh yeah, I mean, I agree. I know, but it's just it doesn't surprise me that somebody would think like that, you know, and that they would think, and therefore I won't create any issues and make any problems for myself. I'll just not put a woman in that scenario. All of us guys can just get on with it, you know.
Yeah. And do you know what's going through my mind right now is, well, if I create my scheme, I'm going to find all those feckers and I'm going to make sure that they have a woman on their team. So that'll show them, won't it? I shouldn't say that. I'll probably just jinx myself now and never create my scheme. But yeah, it's a sad state of affairs that even has to be an issue that any of us face and that any of us have to consider.
Yeah, and I think that what's really great about when someone like you does do this kind of research, it does highlight how things that a lot of people think are very outdated and don't happen anymore do in fact still happen.
Yeah.
You know, so both of those scenarios, some people might say, well, actually, we've dealt with all of that, like that very eminent sound professional that you talked about. Yeah. We've dealt with that. We dealt with that years ago. We did this and we did that. And we had a meeting and we all decided this, this, and this. But when you then start asking people on the ground, in reality, it's not changed as much as we would like to think. And unfortunately, a lot of us, you know, when we experience this discrimination, it's really hard to just say immediately then and there, you are discriminating against me.
Yeah.
And, you know, this stuff kind of goes unsaid and even unnoticed by people who are at the receiving end of it.
Yeah.
But it's still happening.
Big time. And one of the other things that surprised me, well, actually, it didn't surprise me. One of the other findings that was really upsetting was the guy who was trying to change career. He has quite a foreign sounding name. Mm. And, you know, one of the questions I asked was, have you considered changing your name when you apply for jobs? Because he was finding it really difficult to get responses. And he said, no, I'm not going to change my name because that's my identity. Why should I? Why should I change it to something more British sounding to make people, you know, feel at ease or encourage people to respond to me? My CV should speak for itself. My experience should speak for itself. And I was like, do you think it is a race thing? You know, or do you think you're getting discriminated because of your name? And he was like, yeah, completely, but it's very hard to prove. And actually, there has been so many so much research done into proving that this is a thing. It's a bias that people have against foreign sounding names. They just read the name and decide, actually, no, I'm not going to give this person an opportunity because, you know, their English might not be great, or, you know, they're from a different culture. They're not going to fit into the team. It's absolutely ridiculous. Again, that shouldn't be something that's happening.
Yeah, no, I agree. Okay, so Emma, you did mention that you have plans for a scheme then. So has this research helped you to kind of form where you might go in the future with this?
Yeah, so the plan is, now that I have shown that there is an issue, that there are many issues that we need to address, one of the biggest issues is we need to give people from diverse backgrounds and more women opportunities to get into the industry, not just at, you know, the beginning of their career, but also at mid-career level. Because like I said earlier, trying to jump from one genre to another, so from entertainment and factual into high-end drama, is really, really difficult to do. And the UK is experiencing a huge boom in high-end drama right now. There's so many productions being made over here, and there's quite a lot of jobs, but there's not an awful lot of diversity in those jobs, because people at mid-career level are struggling to make the next step because there's no schemes there in place to help them. There's no training available to them. And it's the same at the very, you know, beginning assistant level. Assistant jobs are now going by the wayside in post-production facilities. You don't see as many assistants as you used to. So how is someone from a diverse background going to even get a foot in the door? Like, is it hard to get a foot in the door no matter who you are? It is definitely easier if you're white. If you're from a diverse background, it is much more difficult. So that needs to be addressed. So what I want to do is create a scheme based on the BBC Continuing Drama New Director Scheme. It would take a production and say, if we're talking mid-career level, it would take someone from a diverse background or a woman, and it would assign them onto a drama for an episode or two episodes. What they would do is, if they want to do dialogue editing, they would shadow the dialogue editor on an episode or two episodes of that particular drama. They would learn the workflow, learn how that dialogue editor does things, how they lay out everything for the mixer, who's doing the job. And then after they have done shadowed for one or two episodes, they would then take on an episode themselves, and they would do it from start to finish. And what that does is it gives them training. It gives them training in a supported environment. It exposes them to new people, new clients who may not have been aware of them in the first place. And it also gives them credit. So credits on your CV is just basically gold dust. That will help you lead on to get bigger and better jobs. The other thing it would also do, and this is why it needs to be a funded scheme, it would also pay that person. So that means that the production, the drama, does not feel any risk in taking on this person because they're not paying them. And at the moment, especially with coronavirus, budgets are tight and, you know, a lot of money is having to go into COVID-safe procedures. So asking a production to pay for an extra person is going to be a very, very difficult task to do right now. So if you can say, well, you get an extra person on this job, but you don't have to pay them, but you just, you know, we have to train them up. Yeah. We have to make sure that they get a credit. That's going to be a win-win situation for everybody. That's kind of the plan, but trying to get funding now is going to be the next issue.
And I mean, I can imagine as well that for those teams to have people coming in, even on a temporary basis, who are of more diverse backgrounds, will be just healthy in terms of, you know, being more exposed to the possibility of working with a more diverse team, basically. Yeah.
That's the hope. It's just about changing. You can't reinvent the wheel overnight. And
no,
you cannot change people's minds that quickly. It needs to be a gradual process. And you can't be seen to be forcing something onto people either. So the hope is that by introducing, you know, a new set of people, a new set of qualified, skilled people that are well able to do the job into productions and introduce them to post-production supervisors and people in hiring roles, that they'll begin to take more chances and more risks when they're hiring crews in future. Because that's another big problem, is that we are in an industry that doesn't want to take risks because risks could affect your budget. And like I said, budgets are really tight right now and no one wants to do that. Every penny has to be accounted for. So we'll see. It's going to be a very, very tough job to try and get this funded and off the ground, but I'm kind of determined to do it.
Well, we wish you all the very, very best of luck, Emma. And I'm sure that you've really inspired people listening to this today, not just if they're, you know, hoping or even curious about going into the same kind of industry, but just in terms of seeing an issue, finding a way to find out more about it and, like you say, prove a point. But then also having that, that drive to go and do something about it.
Oh, thank you.
So I think that's really inspiring in itself.
I think prove a point is the best way to describe what I've just done.
Well, it's an important point to prove and sounds like people did not want to hear it. So, you know, I'm really glad that you're on that journey. And I'm just thinking, if there's any women or girls listening to this podcast episode thinking, oh, you know, I love hearing Emma talk about the work that she does, how could I start doing that myself? What's a good way to enter the industry, or what would you advise somebody do to just get started?
Do your research. One of the biggest things that I always say to anybody starting out is decide what you want to do. So if you want to do Foley, start researching all of the Foley studios within the area that you're in, or the immediate, you know, a little outside the area that you're in. Contact all of them. Look, the only reason someone's not going to reply to you is because they're really busy. So if they don't reply to you in a month, follow up and pester them. People do not mind to be pestered. I always say it to everybody who emails me and I forget to reply to them. If they follow up with another email, I always say, please keep on pestering me until I reply. It's just I'm busy and I forget because I'm getting old. If you want to get a runner position in a post-production facility, find out who the head of client services is, because that's the person who hires the runners, not the head of audio. You know, get on your LinkedIn and add all of these people and reach out and say hello. It's one of the most frustrating things that I always experience when I speak to people trying to break into the industry, is they'll ask me for exact names and contact details of people who they need to contact. And I'm like, no, I am not going to do your research for you. You need to do that and make it personal. So when you email someone, do your research about that person, do your research about that facility, find out what they've worked on, and tailor your email to that person or to that company. Because then it shows you actually, you care. And
yeah,
that is a big difference. That is going to be the difference in someone responding to you and someone not.
It sounds from what you're saying, Emma, that it's an industry where reaching out, networking, and starting those relationships is really vital.
Big time. And networking is the one thing that everybody fucking hates doing, because it makes us all feel uncomfortable.
Oh, God. Yeah. I mean, the amount of times that you feel so awkward and like such a dick.
It comes out as passion, not pushy. That's the best way I can put it.
Yeah. I think that sounds like a mantra we all need to be telling ourselves. It's passion, not pushiness.
I think we need
it's
to
okay
get
as well. It's just passion. Oh, well, Emma, it's been so great to have you on the podcast. I mean, but thank you so much for coming on, for the work that you're doing, for the research you've done, and for just being so open and so, you know, honest and vulnerable with us too.
Well, thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
I found talking with Emma so fascinating. And like I said to her just there, truly inspiring that she saw a problem and was determined to uncover both the statistics and personal stories around diversity in the UK TV industry. And now she has some really solid evidence to share with her industry and start making a difference. Her scheme sounds amazing, and I just thought she spoke so articulately about her own experiences working in post-production and how she wants to make a difference. If you think more people should hear Emma's insights and the other amazing guest stories we've featured on the podcast, you know what to do. Rate and review the podcast. It really does help us to hack that algorithm and get in front of even more women, girls, and male and non-binary allies too. Now, in next week's episode, I'm going to be talking about a different stage in the recording process than what we've covered so far here on the podcast, and that is self-releasing. Now, this is something many independent musicians can find really confusing, and understandably, because there's a lot of moving parts. But to keep things simple, I'm going to be sharing three common mistakes that musicians make when they're self-releasing their music, and crucially, how you can avoid them. After over 10 years in the DIY releasing game and millions of Spotify streams to show for it, I know a thing or two about this process. So next week's episode is a must listen if you're planning on releasing music this year or you know you've been putting it off. But till then, take care and I'll catch you soon. So, how'd you like that episode, dear listener? If you loved it, and you know someone else who would love it too, be a good friend and share it with them. Go on, spread the girls' twiddling knobs love.